From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, it remains unclear whether a U.S. drone strike killed a Somali militant leader. The United Nations expresses alarm about Israel's decision to take over land in the West Bank near Bethlehem. We'll have reaction.
Actually, most land that has been expropriated since 1979 is still not settled with actual settlements, actual buildings and people.
And the internet and new technology offer new tools for journalists. It's all ahead. I'm Sarah Williams. Officials are trying to determine whether a U.S. drone strike in Somalia killed Ahmed Abdi Godane, the leader of militant group Al-Shabaab. Somali officials say Monday's attack targeted senior Al-Shabaab leaders meeting in the lower Shabelle region. Witnesses say the drone targeted three vehicles traveling on a road, two of which were hit by multiple missiles, while the third may have escaped. Lower Shabelle's governor, Abdul Qadir Mohamed Noor, told VOA that the airstrike occurred between the towns of Hahwe and Sabelle, about 70 kilometers north of Barawe, an Al-Shabaab stronghold. Noor, who was traveling in the area with African Union troops, said he saw lights followed by a ground-shaking explosion. Sources in the area say Al-Shabaab sealed off the vicinity soon after the attack. There has been no confirmation of casualties. A Pentagon spokesman said only that an operation against Al-Shabaab had taken place and that the United States is assessing the results. Well, African leaders are meeting in Nairobi today to discuss how to tackle terrorism and extremism across the continent. The summit, the first on this topic organized by the African Union, comes amid reports of the U.S. drone strike in Somalia targeting the leader of militant group Al-Shabaab. Mohamed Youssef has more for VOA from Nairobi.
The Nairobi Security Summit is being attended by six heads of state from Nigeria, Chad, Niger, Kenya, Tanzania, and Somalia, and leaders from several other African countries. The African Union's top official for counter-terrorism, Ambassador Francisco Madeira, says the meeting will foster ways on how African countries can combat terrorism and to encourage neighboring countries to share information.
We need decisions, and then we need to see where are the sources of support, material, financial and otherwise, to the different bodies that are dealing with the issue of terrorism, better coordination of action amongst member states, and better sharing of information, operational information, for them to be more effective on the ground, and faster activity against Al-Shabaab, and ACMI, and Boko Haram, and all this.
In the past decade, the African continent has witnessed a major expansion and escalation of terrorist violence. Security experts say the threat of terrorism is accelerating across Africa at an alarming rate. So far, 22 countries have been targeted. The AU's Peace and Security Council reported on terrorism-related issues at an earlier summit in Equatorial Guinea in June. African leaders meeting there expressed deep concern about the threats from Boko Haram in Nigeria, Al-Shabaab in the Horn of Africa, and from Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, which operates in wide areas across the Sahara, Algeria and Morocco. The meeting this week in Nairobi is expected to study the issues raised by the terrorist threat and on effective mechanism to tackle them. Some African countries have been accused of not doing enough and misusing the funds provided to combat terrorism. Burundi's ambassador to Ethiopia and to the African Union, Alan Nyamitwe, notes AU military missions have been successfully deployed to war-hit countries like Somalia and Mali, but he says a lot more needs to be done to fight terrorism on the continent.
So I think the Peace and Security Council is discharging its mandate very well. Of course, seeing no organ of the AU is perfect. That does not mean that we are not doing enough. We are not possibly performing to the level of expectation.
A senior researcher with the Pretoria-based Institute for Security Studies, Martin Iwi, warns of the danger of too easily labelling opposition groups and activists as terrorists.
political parties or political elite can use it against each other. So blaming one another for committing terrorist act or supporting terrorist act or labeling the activities of others. You know, if you look critically into what they are doing might not qualify as terrorism, because that does not help the fight against terrorism in Africa if we are accusing the wrong people who are not terrorists as terrorists.
Meanwhile, hundreds of kilometers away from the summit, a U.S. drone attack in Somalia targeted top commanders of Al-Shabaab, who were meeting late Monday. U.S. and Somali officials say the attack was aimed at Al-Shabaab's top leader, Ahmed Abdi Godane. There was no immediate word on whether Godane survived. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Angry relatives of Iraqi soldiers abducted by Islamic State militants in June have stormed the Iraqi parliament as rights group Amnesty International accuses the Islamic State of ethnic cleansing on a historic scale. Officials in Baghdad said the protesters were refusing to leave the building today and the police were trying to remove them. The Speaker of the Parliament says he will convene a special session of Parliament on Wednesday to discuss the issue. Well, meanwhile, Amnesty International is accusing the Islamic State group of conducting a brutal campaign of ethnic cleansing in northern Iraq. VOA's Al Pessin reports from London.
Amnesty International says Islamic State fighters have conducted mass executions and abductions of members of ethnic and religious minorities and forced nearly a million people to flee their homes. The report is based on interviews with survivors of massacres and other refugees who have fled to Kurdish-held areas and some telephone calls with people trapped in areas controlled by the militants. Speaking via Skype from the Kurdish-controlled Iraqi city of Erbil, Amnesty's senior crisis response advisor Donatella Rovera told VOA the sweeping advance by Islamic State militants has changed the demographic map of northern Iraq in a horrifying way.
The Islamic State has been carrying out a very brutal campaign and has managed in the space of barely a few weeks to remove, ethnically cleanse the entire minority population, the ethnic and religious minorities, from the areas in northern Iraq that are now under the control of the Islamic State.
The militant Sunni Muslim group has targeted Shiite Muslims and a variety of small Islamic and Christian sects, some of which have been living in northern Iraq for centuries. The United States has been bombing Islamic State targets in support of Iraqi and Kurdish forces that are fighting it on the ground. But Rovera says recent gains made by Iraqi forces have only been possible because of the help of Shiite militias, whose reputation is not much better than the Islamic State fighters.
It is very worrying to see that the only way that the Iraqi central government armed forces are finding to bring protection to some vulnerable civilians is by teaming up and cooperating and working alongside brutal militias who are completely uncontrollable and who are very well known for many years for committing horrendous crimes themselves.
Amnesty International calls what's happening in northern Iraq ethnic cleansing on a historic scale. Rovera says the Islamic State is guilty of despicable crimes and of turning some rural areas of Iraq into blood-soaked killing fields. She says 850,000 people have fled the area and are in dire need of help and protection.
These people need everything because they left their home with only the clothes on their back. So they need food, they need shelter, they need medical care. And the international community has been extremely slow in responding.
Rovera says that has improved in recent days after the United Nations called the crisis its number one humanitarian emergency, but she reports very little aid has actually reached the refugees. Rovera says it's too soon to know whether the Iraqi, Kurdish, and U.S. military efforts will roll back the Islamic State's advance, but she says the group has demonstrated that it will not respond to other kinds of international pressure, making the question of how to end the brutality both crucial and, at least for now, impossible to answer. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
Well, United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has given tacit backing to Australia's plan to airlift weapons to Kurdish forces trying to fend off the Islamic State in northern Iraq. Canberra intends to deliver arms and munitions within days. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Prime Minister Tony Abbott said Australia didn't want to be involved in another Middle Eastern war, but would do what it could to avert potential genocide. To try to halt the advance of Islamic State fighters in northern Iraq, Australian military aircraft will fly weapons and ammunition to outgunned Kurdish forces. The mission is being planned with the cooperation of the Iraqi government. Britain, Canada, France and Italy will also join the US-led mission. Mr. Abbott has said that Australian F-A-18 Hornet fighter jets were ready to support US airstrikes against Islamic State militants if requested by the US and Iraqi governments. Mr. Abbott has told the Australian Parliament that the world must stand up to Sunni militants spreading terror in Syria and northern Iraq.
Madam Speaker, I refuse to call this hideous movement Islamic State because it's not a state, it's a death cult. So in good conscience, Madam Speaker, Australia cannot leave the Iraqi people to face this horror, this pure evil, alone.
Tony Abbott's stance on Iraq is supported by the main opposition Labour Party. But Greens Party leader Christine Milne has demanded a full parliamentary debate.
The Prime Minister must tell Australians on what basis are we running after the United States into another imbroglio into Iraq.
Speaking in New Zealand Tuesday, UN Chief Ban Ki-moon said the UN Security Council should discuss ways for the international community to help resolve the crisis in Iraq. He said it was important to contain the further spread of political instability and security instability. Mr. Ban also thanked nations, including Australia, that were taking decisive action to address the threat posed by Islamic State fighters in northern Iraq. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. A Ukrainian official said today that Russian troops have been spotted in 10 locations inside eastern Ukraine, including two major cities, as the United Nations Refugee Agency reported that the number of people displaced by the fighting in eastern Ukraine has doubled in just a month. Andrei Lysenko, a spokesman for Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council, said the Russian armed forces were continuing to concentrate soldiers and military hardware in six areas in the Donetsk region, including the city of Donetsk, and four areas in the Luhansk region, including the city of Luhansk. The two cities are strongholds of pro-Russian separatists. Lysenko said 15 Ukrainian soldiers had been killed in fighting in eastern Ukraine over the previous 24 hours. NATO estimates that at least 1,000 Russian troops are in Ukraine. Russia has repeatedly denied it has any troops there. Pakistan's parliament has reassured embattled Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif of its support against any extra-constitutional attempt to dislodge him. Weeks of anti-government demonstrations in Islamabad have prompted fears of a military intervention in the coup-prone nuclear-armed country. Ayaz Ghul reports from the Pakistani capital.
Parliament opened an emergency session to rally political support for Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif as thousands of protesters continued their agitation just outside the building for a third week. The joint meeting of the National Assembly and Senate took place a day after the Prime Minister vowed not to resign under pressure. The Prime Minister was seated in the House when Interior Minister Chaudhry Nisar Ali told lawmakers protesters were allowed to stage rallies in the center of the capital to respect their democratic rights. But he said the protesters armed with sticks, hammers and other tools, have attacked key installations. This is not a demonstration, a sit-in or a political gathering, the minister said. This is a mutiny against state institutions and the state of Pakistan. Federal Minister Ehsan Iqbal later spoke to VOA to explain the importance of the meeting and the message it has sent to those protesting outside.
The parliament has today with one voice said that the red zone, the area of Islamabad where they are occupying, that should be gotten clear from these miscreants, and there will be no resignation of Prime Minister because the entire parliament stands united behind the Prime Minister. So the democracy is going to prevail.
Lawmakers from Sharif allied parties and opposition groups criticized protesters for resorting to undemocratic ways to demand change. Some suggested that elements in the military might have encouraged the anti-government campaign. But legislators representing the main opposition Pakistan People's Party were also critical of Mr. Sharif's handling of the political crisis and issues concerning ordinary Pakistanis since he took charge 14 months ago. PPP lawmaker Nafisa Shah spoke to VOA after the special parliamentary session.
Yes, many of the things that these protesters are saying are unconstitutional. Some of the way in which they're doing it is wrong. But some things that they're saying merits attention. And we have to be reflective. Why are people out there for 19 days now? So if they're there, there have to be some grievance. And that grievance has to be addressed.
The anti-Sharif protests are led separately by cricketer-turned-politician Imran Khan and populist cleric Tahirul Qadri, who also has Canadian nationality. They demand the Prime Minister resign and elections be held, alleging massive rigging helped the Sharif party win last year. Addressing his supporters outside parliament, Imran Khan said lawmakers from his party would attend Wednesday's parliamentary session to respond to allegations he is working against Pakistani democracy with the military's support. He said the lawmakers will formally quit the parliament soon after their speeches and this will be their final appearance in the House. Monday, Pakistan's military denied as baseless assertions it is behind the twin protests to dislodge the Sharif government because of the trial of former army chief Pervez Musharraf, who was charged with high treason. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
The United Nations Monday expressed alarm by Israel's decision to expropriate 400 hectares of West Bank land near Bethlehem. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon in a statement said seizure of such a large swath of land risks paving the way for further settlement activity, which is illegal under international law and runs counter to the pursuit of a two-state solution. The United States Sunday criticized the Israeli decision as counterproductive to Israel's stated goal of a negotiated two-state solution with the Palestinians. Israel says the decision is in reaction to the June kidnapping and murder of three Israeli teenagers near Bethlehem. Israel has claimed has named three Palestinian suspects. Middle East analyst Michael Fishbach of Virginia's Randolph-Macon University tells VOA's Victor Beatty, if previous land appropriations are any guide, development may be a long way off.
Actually, most land that has been expropriated since 1979 is still not settled with actual settlements, actual buildings and people. It's held, in a sense, in reserve. I think that's really some of the goal. Traditionally, when there have been various attacks on Israelis, settlements have been erected. I'm thinking, as many Israelis have, about the murder of three Israeli teenagers who were inside the West Bank several months ago. So that's a predictable reaction. But whether there will actually be buildings used, erected on the land, remains to be seen because much confiscated Palestinian land has still remained unoccupied. However, they still constitute parts of the so-called settlement zones that Israel has always sought to include within the boundaries of a future Israel after some kind of final settlement. So even if they don't go ahead and erect buildings, it's still carving out more of the West Bank and essentially moving it over, figuratively speaking, on the other side of the wall to become part of Israel someday.
So what does this do to the peace process?
Well, I'm sorry to have to be so candid, but the peace process has been dead actually for a while, really. When Secretary of State Kerry reached the end of his efforts in the spring, it was merely another end to another beginning of a process that has seemingly been never-ending. Now, certainly many people around the world see that as representative of the fact that certainly the parties, a lot of people, the Palestinians would say it's the Israelis, whatever, aren't really working toward a process, that the process itself is the process of ongoing talks. Now, one doesn't have to subscribe to that, but the facts a lot of times do seem to square with that idea, that at some point, people have to get serious and say, is there really going to be a solution or not? But holding talks in order to have more talks about more talks, I think the Palestinians have given up on that. I think Secretary of State Kerry absorbed a lot of diplomatic damage from his inability to get beyond that. So I don't think it can hurt, frankly speaking, it can hurt the peace process much more than it's already hurt these days.
Michael Fishbach of Randolph-Macon University. Chief Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat denounced the land seizure Sunday as part of what he calls Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people and their occupied land. The internet and rapidly evolving technology is quickly changing how people receive news and how journalists deliver it. There are now more ways to tell a story than ever before. One school in Los Angeles is teaching the next generation of journalists with the help of a state-of-the-art newsroom. Elizabeth Lee has this report.
When Faith Miller wanted to study journalism in college, she didn't realize how hands-on the experience would be.
I did not expect that in school I would be reporting on real stories, and I did not know how much work goes into it.
We begin with breaking news.
Unlike their counterparts of past generations, students at the University of Southern California Annenberg School of Journalism learn to deliver news across all platforms, including television, radio, and the web. And that's not all, says Willow Bay, director of the School of Journalism.
Today, we expect journalists to be able to use all sorts of technological tools to research stories, to vet that research, to analyze that research. We expect them to be fluid in multimedia storytelling skills. We expect them increasingly to be their own marketing and distribution arms, to get their stories in front of audiences and to spread those stories as far as they can.
They learn all those skills in a brand new media center built like a modern newsroom. There's a circular assignments desk in the middle of the center with television monitors overhead broadcasting on different channels. More than 90 workstations are spread out around the room where student journalists who work on TV, radio, and the web collaborate side by side. Digital journalism professor Robert Hernandez says future journalists must also be tech savvy, and that means learning basic computer programming languages.
They need to know how the web works and be able to tinker with it.
Hernandez demonstrates some of the modern tools web reporters can use to tell stories in a different way.
You can do 360 panorama through your phone, right? We can talk about what a tornado looks like, how it rips trees out of the ground. Through their phone, there's an app to kind of stitch that together.
Students can also take a class that experiments with Google Glass, a device that connects to the internet and records video and audio. Will Fetterman is a print and digital journalism student.
I think we're entering a market now where if you don't have kind of a wide range of skills and have a little bit of knowledge of everything, you're probably going to have a difficult time finding a job.
The next person to come up with...
The goal is not just to prepare students for the real world, but to also make them savvy enough to adapt quickly to changing technology. But with new technology comes new ethical questions, and future journalists should tread carefully, says the Media Center's executive director, Serena Cha.
In the journalism arena, we've got to consider carefully, how do we teach students to use the tools responsibly? So, yes, new technology often raises new questions because you're able to manipulate reality even more than before.
Faculty members say at the core of all this technology, students still need to learn traditional journalism, how to write and tell a compelling story that is accurate, fair, and balanced. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
Thanks for watching Ann Arbor TV News.
From everyone here at ATVN, you can watch us on the web at ATVN.org. Good night.
Well, thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.